If you're listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Now, think of the last time you put some ice in a beverage. Probably pretty recently, given our summer heat. For me, this morning in my coffee, last night in a mocktail. Did you stop to think about how convenient it is that you have ice on demand? It's probably always been that easy to cool off a drink, right? Well, not so fast. There's a centuries-old story about how we came to use frozen water as a commodity in the U.S. and around the world. It even involves some good old-fashioned hardball business practices right here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you ever had to go without ice or without refrigeration, how did that affect you and your food and beverage choices? How do you use ice in your day-to-day life? Big fan of skating rinks, say? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Brady is executive director of Orion Magazine, a contributing editor for Scientific American and co-editor of The World as We Knew It, Dispatches from a Changing Climate. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What motivated you to stop taking ice for granted and tackle it in this book?
A few years ago, there was a heat wave that gripped the planet, and I was visiting family back in my home state of Kansas. The heat wave knocked out the power into our to their house, and so we piled into their car and went to a nearby gas station that was operating on a generator. Inside, there was air conditioning, there was a soda machine, and I filled a cup with ice to try to cool down. And as I was watching that ice fall into my cup, it just occurred to me that I hadn't thought twice about whether ice would be available. I just knew if I went to that gas station, I'd find it. Or if I went the other direction to the nearby grocery store, I could have bought a bag of ice. And I wondered, why is that the case? Why is ice available everywhere? Because it really isn't in other places around the world. Well, when I got home and the electricity came back on, I tried to do some research to find an answer to that question, and I couldn't find a satisfying answer. So I decided to look more in depth, and ultimately a fascinating history of how ice on demand came to be started to reveal itself. And that was the premise for this book.
Now, back in the day, you could have ice if you were rich and lived in a place that had frozen ponds or rivers nearby. You dig into the story of the first ice entrepreneur in the United States who ends up shipping ice to the Caribbean. Can you share a little bit of his story and how he made this an actual business?
Yeah, the first person to make ice into a business, he was the person who launched the American ice trade. His name was Frederick Tudor. He was a wealthy Bostonian. Some might have called him a madman. People did call him a madman in his day. And as a late teen and then a man in his early 20s, he landed on this idea to carve large blocks of ice out of his family's lake on their estate in Massachusetts and ship it to people who lived in warm climates around the world. And he just knew that once people got a taste of cold, they would never look back, and he would make millions of dollars. And it took years and years of trial and error, but that eventually was the case.
And it wasn't a gimme. The thing he had to do, the marketing technique he stumbled on, was to actually give ice free to bartenders, right, and say, hey, you can make cold rum drinks instead of room temperature rum drinks. How did that catch on?
That's exactly right. So one of the first places that he tried to sell ice to were people living in Cuba. And what he knew after years of failure there, he just couldn't get people to buy his ice, was that nobody in Havana trusted him, but they all trusted their local baristas. Cafe culture was dominant in Cuba. So he went to the local cafes and he said to the owners, look, I'm going to give you some ice for free. And that way you can use it to make these most delicious drinks. And then you can sell it to your customers at the same price as you would sell lukewarm drinks. And let's just see which one they like the best. Well, just as in today, back then, you really can't argue with a cold drink on the rocks. And people clamored for it. And he ended up making a killing.
Talking to Amy Brady about her new book, Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts on ice, its accessibility, its history. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living in Lowell, and the bartender said that there was a tunnel underneath this bar, and we thought about what it could possibly be. Then I went and did a little bit of investigation. It was a tunnel from the river up through the bar to the brewery at the top of the hill, and they would take horses and cut big blocks of ice out of the river and take them up through the tunnel all the way from the brewery down to the river, and they put hay on top of them, and then they put the beer in there, and it lasted all summer.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing that story. Now, Amy, that wasn't the only place that was happening in Wisconsin. You write of an ice war in Milwaukee where they were supplying ice to brewers, making cold German lagers there. What ended up happening?
This is one of my favorite stories that came out of my research. So in the early 20th century, around 1900, 1901, there was a company harvesting ice out of the Milwaukee River that went by, ironically, as the Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company. And Wisconsin Lakes was the only ice company in the region for years and years and years. But then that changed when another company came in called the Pike and North Lake Company that started harvesting ice out of Lake Michigan. Well, this was at the peak of the Industrial Revolution when rivers were really, really dirty. And so the Pike Company launched this smear campaign against Wisconsin Lakes that was harvesting out of the Milwaukee River, saying that their ice was really dirty. Well, Wisconsin Lakes didn't take kindly to that. So they looked at Pike Company's infrastructure to see, is there any way that we can get back at them? And sure enough, what they realized was that the Pike Company had bought land to build their ice houses close to the railroads, the same type of railroads that was probably delivering ice to that bar that your caller just talked about. But what they had failed to do was to buy the land between the ice houses and the railroads. So Wisconsin Lakes ended up buying that intermediate land area and then waited until Pike Company had harvested a bunch of ice and was ready to bring it to the railroads for delivery. And when they did that, Wisconsin Lakes slapped them with a trespassing order, and all of their ice went to waste. Well, Pike Company decided this was war. And so what they did in retaliation was really one of the best acts of revenge I think I've ever read. What they did is that they waited until that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting for their next big delivery. Now, at the time, river tourism was pretty popular. And so what Pike Company did is that they bought a steamship and sold tickets to tourists. But what separated their steamship from all the other touristy steamships is that they outfitted theirs with an icebreaker. And so right when Wisconsin Lakes was getting ready to harvest their ice, they filled the ship, they hired a band to play a jazzy tune, and as the band played, they brought their steamship right through the ice that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting, sending the ice harvesters running and breaking that valuable ice into millions of splinters. It was really like Titanic in reverse.
Pretty cold-hearted. Now, Amy, before we enter the industrial ice era, I want to check out a historical character I didn't know existed. Now, we get to a point where people have ice boxes in their house. They get ice deliveries, right into their door. And there's this iconic figure of the sexy ice man. Tell us about him.
So one of the most fascinating things I uncovered in my research was that by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when ice delivery to people's homes was reaching its peak, we also find all of these popular songs with lyrics about housewives falling in love with the Iceman. I also found these vintage Valentine's Day cards with puns about the sexy Iceman. And I was wondering, why is this? Why was this nation fascinated with Icemen? Because they weren't the only delivery men of the era. There were milkmen, there were mailmen. But what I realized is that of all the delivery people of the era, the Iceman was the only one to come inside the house to bring their product to the kitchen. And they would often come into the house when the husband was away at work. And this was a time when there was a lot of anxiety around women being alone with men who weren't their husbands. And so this created a nationwide fascination and an anxiety around the Iceman. One of my favorite cultural finds was this song that was written in the 1930s that was later popularized by Ray Charles that went something like, I'm moving to the outskirts of town and I'm buying my woman a Frigidaire so we can get rid of that Iceman.
We're talking to Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about ice, how we used to get it, what led to the era of freezers in every home? Do you rely on ice for entertainment? Maybe that skating rink, curling, for example? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Orion Magazine executive editor Amy Brady. We're talking about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're big, it turns out, on ice here in the United States. I know I am. Have you traveled to someplace where ice wasn't really a thing? What was that like for you? Or are you from outside of the United States? Are you wondering, what's our deal with all the ice? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy, the creation of artificial ice, not collected from nature, it changed our beverages, our food, a lot of other things. And another, you spent a chapter or two on sports, and this really shook things up, especially in the ways that women could be out doing sports in public. Can you talk about, artificial ice surfaces and how they change things?
Absolutely. So ice skating was really popular in the early 19th century, even before we had indoor skating rinks. And one of the reasons why they were so popular was because young couples could enjoy ice skating outdoors together, spending time together, without being under the watchful eye of a guardian. ice skating really was seen as the domain of young people, lest an older person fall and hurt themselves, or so went the thinking of the day. And so because it was so popular among young couples, women were encouraged to take part in the activity. And at the time, there were some, but not a lot of physical sports-like activities that women were encouraged to participate in. And so because women were ice skating, they had to consider how their garments affected their ability to stay upright on the slippery ice. And this was an era when women's skirts were very long. And so it was easy to trip on them. So they started hiking up their skirts and ultimately started buying clothing that was just a little bit shorter so that they wouldn't trip over their garments. And so in this way, ice skating led to changing social mores about women showing off their ankles and wearing shorter hemlines.
And then we had sports like curling and hockey that existed in some forms on frozen ponds before that, but the ability to create this surface, and not just when it was cold, how did it change those games?
Well, prior to indoor ice skating, sports like ice hockey and curling, though curling barely existed in the United States before indoor ice rinks. It was really just ice hockey and ice skating. Prior to the invention of indoor skating rinks, these were activities that were only experienced in northern climates where ice formed naturally. But once we had the ability to create indoor skating rinks, we could bring that popular pastime of ice skating that once only took place on, say, the Wisconsin, the Milwaukee River or the Hudson, could suddenly take place in Florida or Arizona. And that radically popularized sports. Now there are, ice skating rinks in almost every state in the union. And there aren't a lot of sports where you can say that it's, so popular that there are spaces dedicated to it in every single state.
Your book is bookended with a change in climate. Ice becomes less available at the end of the little ice age. Rivers and lakes aren't freezing as much. And now there's concern. In an irony, you write, we're using a lot of energy to make ice to help us deal with the heat, but that in turn is contributing to climate change. Can you talk about some of those concerns?
Yeah, well, the popularization of ice and the need for cold, the American need for cold, led to the rise of electric refrigeration. And today, there are approximately 110 million electric refrigerators working in the United States alone. And a majority of those refrigerators have automated ice makers, which means that the refrigerator, which is already takes a significant energy draw, draws even more energy because those automated ice makers have motors that never turn off. That's why you can have ice at any time of day or night. Well, all of that energy use is starting to take a toll on the planet. The cooling industry contributes approximately 10% of all carbon emissions, which is means it's not the most significant contributor of global warming, but it's not insignificant. And as somebody who absolutely loves ice, I'm never giving up my ice. I love it. But also, as somebody who believes in living as gently on the earth as I can, I was curious to learn, are there experts thinking about this problem? And are there any solutions that might be possible in my lifetime? And I
And
was so excited to learn that there are people who are experimenting with technologies such as certain types of magnets, with a material called plastic crystals, which actually have nothing to do with plastic. It's a word that describes their structure, the molecular structure. They're learning that these materials can actually mimic the type of compression technology that more conventional refrigerators use that draw considerably less energy. And they also don't rely on the same type of traditional refrigerants that contribute to global warming that conventional refrigerants do. So I'm very excited about this. If we can scale up that technology, that could be a game changer for the cooling industry. And gosh, if there's anything I've learned in writing this book, is that Americans can adapt new types of technology and make widespread transformations in a relatively short amount of time.
talking to Amy Brady about her new book called Ice. Let's bring on another caller. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the subject. And about in 2019, I took a trip to Alaska. And on one of the excursions, we were served glacial ice in our drinks. And it was just so totally awesome. It was like a blue-white. And it was a great experience, yeah.
Could you tell the difference in the drink, Laura?
it was just, I think it was partly just in your head. You just realized it was so cold and delicious. I don't know.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. Amy, that actually that brings me around to something you spent some time in the book, the aesthetics of ice in our drinks. And there are people who argue, I think, about the best shape of ice, the best source of ice to have in our cocktails. What do we know?
Well, the shape, the size, the texture of the ice that you put in your drink can radically change the flavor. Different sizes of ice dilute at different speeds. Some ice is actually just colder than other types of ice. And then there's also the way that ice looks. Ice straight out of a conventional ice machine is a little bit cloudy. in the center. And what some bartenders are thinking about is whether a clear ice can make a difference. And what their clientele is telling them is that, yeah, it does make a difference. The drink tastes better. And to my mind, it also just looks better. And so when you go to an upscale cocktail bar in this day and age, don't be surprised if the ice in your cocktail looks extra fancy. And also don't be surprised if that cocktail costs a little more than you're used to, because super clear ice is pretty expensive.
Thanks for that call, Laura. And that takes me back to something early in your book, Amy. Now, the early blocks of ice you mentioned, towed by horses. Now, I've been in marching band back in high school, and I marched in parades behind horses. I know what comes out of the back of horses. This was an issue for our ice quality back in the day, right?
Oh boy, was it ever. So ice harvesters often employed horses to help cut the ice and then to haul it out of the lakes and rivers and into the back of wagons so that it could be delivered to people's homes. And as you say, you know, horses being the mammals that they are, often let loose their bowels on the ice, the very ice that would soon touch the mouths of thirsty Americans everywhere. And so all ice harvesting crews employed a man who would pull what was called a shine sleigh. And the job of the shine sleigh was to scrape the horse's waste off the ice so that it could be delivered. And it got its name from the oily shine that it would leave behind.
Yum. That's a great place to leave it. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can keep sharing your thoughts on ice. Do you have a favorite ice to put in a particular beverage? Let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, advice is everywhere, but it's not all good. We talk about how to tell if the advice you're getting, whether it's from friends, parents, strangers on the internet, is good or should be ignored. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum.
We recently received a question from Elizabeth Renner of Madison. She asked us, through WPR's Wisconsin Project, why are tubas such a prominent part of the UW-Madison band? And why are they so popular in Wisconsin? WPR's Tim Peterson marched right down to the Madison campus to get some answers.
The tuba has a long and deep history in Wisconsin. In the mid-1800s, a lot of Germans immigrated to the area, bringing their music, their refreshments, and their instruments with them. That's according to John Stevens, a longtime tuba performer and composer in Wisconsin. He's also professor emeritus of music at UW-Madison.
The basic German culture of the state, I think, has a lot to do with it. Polka bands, bands and beer, if you will.
But the tuba and polka music really got oompa-pa-ing around the Civil War era. Military band music was popular, with big names in Wisconsin like the Broadhead Brass Band. Fast forward to today. The tuba is still very much alive and well, especially on UW's campus. Looking into the tuba questions made me want to know more about what it's like to be a tuba on Wisconsin football game days.
Before the game, we'll actually parade around the city and go to some of the different places on Regent Street and play right up close to the crowd there.
That's Gabe Kepke. He's a tuba player in the UW Marching Band. The iconic band dates back to 1885, just 2 decades after the end of the Civil War. It started as a military-style ensemble, a bit smaller than today's group. Another tuba player is Max Collins. He says the band has a protocol for how members are supposed to act in uniform. But as tubas,
we get to mess with people a little bit more. If we see fans in the opposing colors, we kind of just play at their face a little bit.
Then there's the pregame and halftime performances at Camp Randall.
We're so big, you can see the bell from anywhere in a stadium.
That's Joseph Klug, another UW tuba player.
I know other instruments, they have hats with massive plumes on them, and so you can clearly tell whenever they're looking around. For us, it's you can clearly tell if we're facing the wrong way.
Corey Pompey is the UW Marching Band Director and Associate Director of Bands at UW-Madison. He says the notes tubas play are the roots of every chord, the bass lines that everything else the band plays are built on.
It's just an important sound, an important voice in the band that we just have to have.
During game day performances, the tubas assert themselves with a couple of additional antics. One of Kepke's favorites is when the tuba section builds a human pyramid. And in a tradition going back to the 1950s, the tubas famously embark on a march around the field during the second half.
We play a version of On Wisconsin, that's all tuba. We also play a version of You Said It All, that's all tuba. So when we're going around and playing the melody for people, it's like, it makes you feel like a star. It's awesome.
Pompey agrees. Pompey also says he enjoys just being around the tubas. They're fun. They tell jokes. They don't take things too seriously.
I should also note that it's an extremely hard-working group of people, and you have to be in order to carry that heavy instrument around for as long as they do.
And they just have a special bond. Collins says it's something he loves about being a UW tuba.
All 20 of us pretty regularly kind of hang out, so having that many people that you're just close to just because you are really makes it feel like you belong somewhere and really makes you feel like a part of something.
So keep an eye out for this pack of rhinos, as they call themselves, next game day, especially if you're not wearing cardinal red and white.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that piece on tubas in Wisconsin. And that story idea came through WPR's Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now it's easy to find advice in this world. Friends and family, randos on the internet, everyone can be a source of advice, even if you didn't ask for it. So how are we supposed to know if someone's opinion, whether it's a professional opinion or an unsolicited one, is actually worth listening to? Advice giving and taking is an age-old pastime. Historians say advice columns have been around for at least 300 years. Our next guest interviewed advice-giving experts to get some advice about how to figure out what advice to take and what to trash. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's the best advice you've ever gotten? What's the worst advice you've ever gotten? Do you try to share advice with other people? When and where and when do you just clam up and listen? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Allie Volpe is a senior reporter at Vox. Allie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
What led you to seek advice about advice for your piece, Allie?
Yeah, it's funny. It is a little meta. A lot of what I cover does require me reaching out to experts and getting their advice on a variety of topics. And a workplace discussion kind of veered down this topic of like, well, what advice is good advice? And so I was kind of working with the working headline of advice about advice. So I figure, you know, if we are doling it out, we might as well teach people what advice to take and what to ditch.
Now, in general, there have been some studies on this, and it sounds like getting advice, if we do it right, it can help us make better decisions. What do we know?
Right. Like we all know what we know and we don't know what we don't know. We have our biases. We have our blinders up to certain things. There was studies that actually showed if you got advice from a sports fan who was a fan of a team you weren't rooting for, you made a better bet on how the game would resolve if you, you know, took their advice instead of just going with your gut, hoping that your preferred team would win. So taking advice does help us make better decisions, but we're not very good at taking that advice, even if we've asked for it ourselves, research shows.
How do we make sure we're getting advice that might actually confront our blind spots, as opposed to so-and-so thinks, we don't think this out loud probably, but so-and-so thinks like I do, they'll back me up in this decision I'm making, whether it's right or not. How do we get make sure we're getting a positive committee, not a a yes-men kind of committee?
Right. I think it's important to think about who's giving the advice. Is it somebody who has expertise in the area we're looking for advice in? I maybe wouldn't go to my best friend for legal advice if they do not have that sort of expertise. So I think it's important to look at where that advice is coming from, because maybe oftentimes a close friend or a family member might just be saying what they think we want to hear, and instead of what we actually need to hear.
Now, if we don't want to hear advice, how can we put ourselves, or the advice that's going to help us, how do we put ourselves in a mindset to say, okay, this isn't what I wanted to hear. Maybe I need to take it seriously, though.
So what I found interesting from reporting this piece is sometimes we do get that advice that is like, I don't want to do this. This feels hard. This feels difficult. But sometimes that's what we need to do. I found it interesting that people often take advice when it is it aligns with our life, it addresses a problem, and it's feasible to achieve, and it doesn't have any major consequences or side effects. So sometimes good advice just comes in bad packages. Like sometimes a parent might tell us advice in a condescending manner, or advice might feel that it is too difficult. But sometimes we just need to take a step back and think about it. That bit of advice that we maybe thought was too hard or didn't align with our lives maybe is the thing we should do. I talked to an advice columnist who talked about someone who wrote in asking for advice on whether to ask out somebody who they had a crush on. And so the hard thing to do would to give the advice of yes, ask out that person. That is a vulnerable thing that sometimes might give us butterflies. It might feel bad, but it's the right thing to do. Sometimes the hard thing or the thing that gives us the negative reaction is the right thing to do.
We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media, Aaron Cook, one of our HR people, says the first thing I always try to do is filter the advice through several lenses. Is this advice helpful or hurtful? The result of knowledge and experience versus bias. Is it a judgment or an actual critique on any sort of content? Finally, I consider where the advice is coming from and where I stand in relation to it. Who's the expert? Is this something creative or emotional? A long line of filters there for advice, Allie. Aaron is clearly thinking about ways to figure out what advice is good or not. What did you hear from experts when it came to evaluating advice in those ways?
Yeah, definitely the panel of getting a lot of different opinions was something that experts definitely sang the praises of. Getting a number of different viewpoints helps us to consider all angles that we maybe didn't consider. But then there comes a point where if you are just asking dozens and dozens of people, maybe you haven't really thought about what you actually want. So it is helpful if you can get a clear consensus from a panel of a handful of people. But if you feel the need to keep asking people, you probably just don't know what you want.
We're talking about how to tell if we're getting good or bad advice with Allie Volpe, senior reporter at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you tell if you're getting good advice or bad advice? Any advice you regret taking or not taking in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about sorting out good advice from bad with Allie Volpe. She's a senior reporter. She wrote about this at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ellen is with us in Peterborough. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Oh, this one is kind of odd. I was in a very intense year-long program at Milwaukee Mental Health Complex. I received very good care, and I had a psychiatrist who saw me every week. At the end of that year, his last advice to me was, watch those left turns, Ellen. And as a person who drives a lot, I have found that he was right. But I think it's hilarious that after that, you know, that was his advice.
I love it, Ellen. I thank you for sharing that, Ellie. I like that in part because, okay, we've been through this long experience, but here's some really, I don't know, grounding, very practical advice that's going to help anybody who, in this case, anybody who drives.
Right. Sometimes the most practical thing is the best thing to do. And the advice that sort of takes us by surprise, I find the most memorable and that I will actually use.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Ellen, at 800-642-1234. Yeah, what I hope my kids take away from growing up in my house is careful on the steps, because stairs are great, but yeah, they'd be dangerous if you're not careful on them. Now, looking back at the experts you talked to, Allie, sometimes we offer advice when it isn't really being solicited. How can we be careful not to give that unwanted advice?
Right. And I am so guilty of this sometimes. Sometimes all people want is just to vent. They don't want advice. And I found it's actually just really easy to ask somebody straight up, do you want advice or do you just want me to listen? And no one is ever really offended by that. And oftentimes people just want you to listen. And so I make sure when I'm about to vent to a friend or get their advice, I'll often preface it with, oh, I really want your advice on this, or can I tell you about something? And I think that sort of guides the conversation so you're not getting unsolicited advice.
We heard from Susan in Suamico. She says the best advice she was ever given was from her father when she was pregnant with her first. She said the advice was the best thing to spend on your child is time. Oh, I like that. So that's an example of someone with a specific bit of experience. It was her dad talking about child raising. I don't know. Are there good general kinds of advice that we can reach out to and get that kind of wisdom?
I love that bit of advice. Something an expert told me that really stuck out to me was somebody who's in the quote unquote messy middle of an experience often has really good insight, even though they might feel that they don't. So a parent who maybe has toddlers and they're in the middle of it is better suited to give advice about parenting than maybe someone who's an empty nester, because you are the one who's actually experiencing it every day.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Well, to follow up on an earlier comment, UPS used to instruct their drivers to make 3 right turns on a block instead of taking a left to prevent accidents. But my advice, I'm not sure if it was a line in a movie or on a TV show or something from one of my grandfathers or an uncle or my dad, but it was in the context of an Italian restaurant, and it was simply, don't fill up on bread.
I love it, Tom. And have you lived by this rule?
Actually, I've probably strayed from it, but I think that when I think of it, it means the main course is still coming.
Excellent. Tom, thanks a lot for sharing that. We're asking for your best or worst advice ever given or received. Allie Volpe wrote about how we evaluate advice we get. She's a senior reporter at Vox. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our own Larry Mueller, host of the Larry Mueller Show here at Wisconsin Public Radio, told us, my high school guidance counselor told me I should not attend UW-Madison, but find a smaller school where I'd have a better chance to succeed. I asked my dad about it, and he said I should go where I want, and if I failed, I could try another school. So Larry says, I went to UW-Madison, succeeded, eventually became a full professor at UW, and had a pretty successful radio career on campus, I would add, Larry. Allie, when we're making a big, or at least what feels at the time, like a huge life decision, like where should I go to college, or what job should I seek, or whatever, what did you learn from the people you interviewed about how to seek out useful advice?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that we tend to favor advisors who are more confident, but those people might not always be the most accurate. So I think it's important to get diverse points of view. Like, we tend to seek out people who are similar to us. So finding people who have a different experience than we do in getting advice can often help lead us in the right direction. So it's funny that the guidance counselor, you know, said one thing, dad said another thing. And so you kind of just take the average of those two bits of advice, which experts say is actually a good way to go.
We'll go back to our callers now. Ganado is with us in Milwaukee. Ganado, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I'd love to see two media sources that I love combined together. I read Ali's articles as well on Vox all the time. But my piece of advice that I wanted to talk about was when I first started grad school, I was not doing super hot because I had just moved to Milwaukee and was starting a new job, and so it wasn't my primary focus in life. I had asked one of my friends who was recently in grad school, like, hey, should I stay with the course or drop it? He suggested that I stay, which not a very good decision because GPA requirements in grad school are very different from undergrad. So I ended up my first semester in academic probation. So a funny story there. I think we both lacked some context, but just wanted to share that.
Well, I hope things got better.
They did. I did graduate, and things turned out fine in the end.
Yay. Okay. Glad to hear that part of it. But, Ali, I think sometimes there's an instinct to say when you give advice, stick to it. Power through. Don't give up. And sometimes giving up, as in the case of Ganado's class, might be the right advice.
Right. And I think that comes back to sort of the criteria that good advice fulfills, you know, whether it solves a problem, is feasible, and doesn't have any consequences. I would argue, you know, spending a lot of money on something that, you know, you might not achieve at is a pretty big consequence or side effect. And therefore that advice maybe isn't the best.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Now, one expert told you, this is in like broadening horizons here, don't just consider advice from people who have succeeded, right? Because that seems obvious. Seek out people maybe in similar situations who have failed in one way or another. Why is that helpful?
Yeah, one expert gave an example of someone who has been divorced and getting marriage advice from them. They can kind of see the other side. They can see where things have gone wrong, maybe things that they would have done differently. Not to say that we should only be seeking advice from people who have failed something, but they have a unique perspective on, you know, things that didn't go right. That same expert also said getting advice from somebody who, you know, is in the middle of something is really helpful as well. Like somebody who's maybe like in the middle of training for a marathon, but they are like exhausted by it. But giving advice to someone who is a little bit less experienced can help like revive them a little bit and get them excited and remind them why they're doing it.
I want to talk about a source of advice that previous generations weren't lucky enough to have access to, random people on the internet. What did experts say about the advice of, you know, the whole planet online?
Yeah, everyone loves to give advice online. And I think it comes down to just some basic media literacy tips. You know, anyone can post a TikTok telling you how to wake up earlier in the morning. And you might feel susceptible to that. Like, yeah, I can achieve so much more if I got up early. But one, you need to think about, like, do you actually want that advice? Or are you just kind of consuming it passively and think that's something that you might need for your life, but it doesn't actually fit in with your schedule? Something else is like that any person online can put up a video. But what is their credentials? What is their expertise? My colleague, Rebecca Jennings, did this great piece about online influencers posting online courses to their YouTube pages or, you know, getting people to pay money for online courses that they have set up themselves. So do they have any expertise in that? I don't know. Are they just looking to get money? Probably. So if a person is, you know, saying something or doing something to solicit some sort of reaction from somebody, whether that is to be angry or to give them money, I would be skeptical of their advice.
It's a good place to leave it. Ali, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Ali Volpe, senior reporter at Vox. She talked to us about her recent article, How to Tell When You're Getting Good Advice.